This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
You lose such a person, such a kind of energized person is a big, big loss. And I would say we are, in terms of country, we are in a state, almost in a state of coma and shock.
That's journalist and commentator Fernando Lima commenting on the death of Mozambican opposition leader Afonso Dhlakama. Details next. Also, Burundi has ordered VOA and the BBC to shut down their services in the country for 6 months. And Tunisia prepares to hold the first free municipal elections since its 2011 revolution. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the sudden death of Mozambique's longtime rebel leader and opposition chief has caused shock and concern in the Southern African nation and in the region. Afonso Dhlakama was negotiating a deal with President Filipe Nyusi to finally lay down arms, and the status of the agreement and how it will affect the gas-rich nation is now in question. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Afonso Dhlakama, who died Thursday at the age of 65, was never far from the action in Mozambique. He led the Renamo rebel group through a bruising 16-year civil war that ended in 1992. He then led Renamo's transformation into a political party and ran for president unsuccessfully 5 times. In 2013, frustrated with what he said were attempts by the ruling Frelimo party to stymie the opposition, Dhlakama retreated to the bush in northern Mozambique and led his supporters in a low-level insurgency. In the months before his death, he and President Filipe Nyusi were making progress on a peace deal. Nyusi confirmed Dhlakama's death in a telephone call on national television late Thursday. Nyusi said he had been told Dhlakama was ill and had attempted to send him abroad for treatment the day before he died. Nyusi did not provide details on the illness. Journalist and commentator Fernando Lima said the nation was stunned by the news.
To lose such a person, such a kind of energized person, is a big, big loss. And I would say we are, in terms of country, we are in a state, almost in a state of coma and shock.
Analyst Lisa Lovodran of the Institute for Security Studies says Dhlakama's death also leaves unanswered many serious questions. Dhlakama led Renamo since 1979. And did not leave a clear successor.
His death, his untimely death, really puts a question mark over this peace deal and whether it will now be implemented.
The U.S. State Department, among others, accused Renamo of committing crimes against humanity, including mass killings, mutilations, forced labor, and recruitment of child soldiers in its war effort. But Lima said that Dhlakama's legacy is ultimately a positive one, despite the serious allegations.
It would not be for a person such as Dhlakama, the civil liberties in this country would be much more jeopardized. I cannot have the media I have and the freedom I have if it would not be for Dhlakama and what he have done for this country, despite he carry this message through a really violent and the bloody insurgency, but we have those achievements and everybody benefits from those achievements.
Lovodran notes big economic implications are at stake in the wake of Dhlakama's death, as Mozambique's natural gas wealth is being developed.
Much of this political strife these last couple of years should also be seen in that context, where here you have an expectation of new wealth in Mozambique, but you have a lot of corruption. The Frelimo government has been wrecked by this one scandal after the other. But so within that backdrop, it is very important for stability to return to Mozambique.
Nyusi said during his phone call on national TV that this is a bad time for Mozambique. Shlakama was preparing to run for president again in polls next year. Anita Pal, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Burundi has officially kicked off campaigning ahead of the May 17th referendum. Government officials are telling people to vote yes to the constitutional changes, which they say would provide a much-needed update to the country's political system. However, critics say the initiative is all about extending the current president's rule. The government also announced today that it plans to ban VOA and the BBC services in the country for 6 months, starting Monday. VOA director Amanda Bennett issued a statement saying such a move would deprive the citizens of Burundi of a trusted news source during a critical time. For VOA, Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Burundi's President Pierre Nkurunziza has made his opinion on the proposed constitutional changes clear. Speaking at a rally in the second largest city, Gitega, Wednesday, he warned those who want to vote no. He says, "I would like to declare this to Burundians and those who are not. Whoever opposes these constitutional changes will meet God's power." The most controversial proposed amendment deals with president term limits, a topic that has already led to deadly unrest in Burundi in recent years. The current term is 5 years, but the new amendment will give the president a 7-year mandate. The constitution limits the president to 2 terms, but it is argued that the change will reset the clock for Nkurunziza to run twice more. He has been in office since 2005. If the referendum passes, Nkurunziza could potentially stay in power until 2034. Agathon Rwasa is a former presidential candidate and vice president of the National Assembly. He is campaigning for no. He told VOA there are threats everywhere.
There are threats when we want to hire some cars for displacement of our people. There are threats that if they hire their vehicles to our group, they will be banned. So it is a big challenge, but we do hope that this threat won't be effective.
The government has insisted the changes are aimed at strengthening the country's laws to bring an end to the political upheaval the country has witnessed over the years. Human rights groups have expressed concerns over the political environment in which the referendum is being held. They say the ruling party youth wing, known as Imbonerakure, is targeting those suspected to be campaigning or are planning to vote against their party wishes. Human Rights Watch says opponents of the referendum have faced beatings and arrest in the run-up to the vote. Human Rights Watch researcher Lewis March says it will be difficult to get a fair result.
It's happening in the context of state killing of people who are against Nkurunziza's third mandate, which we saw most significantly in 2015. It's happening in a context in which journalists and civil society have either been locked up or kicked out of the country, and in which opposition internally is either muzzled or ceases to exist. So it's a very worrying perspective in terms of the medium and long term.
At least 1,200 people have lost their lives since Nkurunziza announced his bid for a third term in 2015, and more than 400,000 Burundians have fled the country. On Friday, Burundi's National Communications Council announced a 6-month ban on broadcast by Voice of America and the BBC. The council say the broadcasters have broken the country's media laws and engaged in an unethical conduct. The United States was a strong critic of the president's decision to seek a third term in 2015, and more recently denounced the alleged acts of violence against opponents of the referendum. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
On Sunday, Tunisia, the only success story in the Arab Spring, will hold the first free municipal elections since its 2011 revolution. Tunisians consider the balloting a step towards local empowerment that also can reverse the imbalance between coastal towns and inner regions. However, parliamentarians acknowledge many challenges remain in the transition towards democracy. From Washington, reporter Mohamed El-Shenawi has the story.
After being postponed four times, the municipal elections come as a relief to many Tunisians who felt that the revolution has failed to deliver its promises. Former Tunisian President Ben Ali's last budget allocated only 18% of state funds to the inner regions, while 82% went to the coastal towns. According to a World Bank report, highly centralized form of government in Tunisia had complicated the task of building trust between the consecutive Tunisian governments and Tunisian citizens. Osama Zghayr is a member of the Tunisian parliament from Ennahda party. He says negotiations already started to change the Tunisian government.
The main important issue is about the local election. We have a possible changing of the government after the local election, and we have also right after this election, we're going to start again to prepare for another election, the presidential and parliamentary election in the end of the 2019.
He said, while the municipal elections could lead to fix the imbalance between the inner regions and coastal towns, the change of government could widen the coalition with more parties instead of relying basically on the two large parties of Ennahda and Nida Tunis. However, there are an array of challenges still facing the Tunisian transition toward democracy. Zghayr says Tunisia's ability to overcome its economic crisis is severely hampered by depending on foreign loans and lack of foreign investment. Khalid Choket is a member of the executive committee of Nida Tunis, the party with majority in the coalition. He says 90% of candidates for municipal elections are below the age of 40 years. Thus, Tunisian young generation would enjoy the opportunity to contribute to the democratic transition in the country. But he pointed to a serious challenge that consumes a good portion of the limited budget.
We have spent 4 billion dinar to support our military and security institutions in this war against terrorism. But 4 billion dinar is very high amount for a country like us with a budget of 35 billion dinar a year.
Choket says, unless Tunisian poor and middle class feel that their economic situation is improving, democratic transition and consecutive elections would not address Tunisians' frustrations. Not all is doom and gloom in Tunisia. According to Radwan Masmoudi, president of Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy in Tunisia.
I think Tunisia has made a lot of progress, especially compared to the other countries. I think consensus is the key to keeping the unity, and that has not worked in other countries. It has kept peace and it has kept stability and progress and Tunisia moving forward. I think we still have a lot of work to do.
Masmoudi says, on the average, democratic transition takes up to 20 years to be completed, so Tunisia is on the right track. Eric Brown is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. He echoes Masmoudi's assessment and says the U.S. should support Tunisia as a role model for democratic transition in spite of the challenges it faces.
I think it is something that the United States needs to honor. And by honor, I mean deep investment, coming up with a strategy, coming up with a policy that sees far, well into the future, and helps to create the conditions in which Tunisia's patriots have the security, the economic and political conditions in which they can build their republic and make it last.
Brown says there is a close cooperation between the U.S. military and the Tunisian army, but the United States should widen the cooperation to include other areas, especially the economy, to help democratic transition in Tunisia to succeed. Mohammed El-Shinawi, VOA News, Washington.
19 past the hour, you're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Officials say an earthquake at a South African gold mine killed four workers yesterday and trapped three others 3 kilometers underground. Rescue operations were complicated by loose material at the accident site and a pair of aftershocks today at the Sabanye Gold Company mine. A power outage at another Sabanye mine trapped 1,000 workers for almost a day. although safety at South Africa's mines has improved since the end of apartheid a quarter century ago, it remains a dangerous profession. The Congress of South African Trade Unions says there have been more than 25 deaths this year. Cave-ins aren't the only risk. The accident came the same day that six South African gold mining companies reached a nearly $400 million settlement with thousands of workers who contracted the deadly respiratory disease, silicosis. In Kenya, at least 100 people have lost their lives over the last 2 months following heavy rains pounding many parts of the country. The downpour is also hampering transportation and destroying food crops. From Nairobi, Ruben Chama reports.
The heavy rains have cut off roads and left a trail of destruction in many parts of the East African nation. In Nairobi, Kenya's capital, several roads have been affected. Just as Mutuku is a manager of a public transport service company, Prestige Shuttle. He says that rains are causing heavy traffic jams.
Kutoka Kipande Road, Misiam, that road roundabout Grove Cinema, kupanda mpaka huko juu, ina take time sana. Sababu barabara inajaa maji, hakuna draining systems. Naomba tu kama inawezekana watutengenezee hiyo draining systems.
The route from Kipande Road via Museum Hill and Globe Roundabout up to the city center gets too congested from flooding. He says he's appealing to the government to fix the drainage system, which is causing problems for businesses. He says it takes 3 hours for vehicles to get from that area to the city center. Kenyan officials have warned residents living in flood-prone areas to move to safer grounds, fearing that the situation may worsen. According to the Kenya Red Cross, at least 100 people have died, while some 200,000 others across the country have been affected by raging floods. Fernand Dingila is the emergency response manager of the Kenya Red Cross.
As at today, we have recorded a total of slightly more than 3,000 households which have been displaced from their houses by the floods, and which translates to 211,155 people. And they had to move from either their houses have been destroyed by the waters.
In central Kenya, 8 people were reported to have died when a landslide swept away their homes. Overflowing rivers have also blocked major roads, including the route from Nairobi to the port of Mombasa. Jeremiah Nyakairu is a public service bus driver.
The main challenge we've had is the poor state of the road, where we have had repairs become now potholes. So when it rains, you cannot see the potholes. And what happens is that on a number of occasions, you hit the potholes, and as a result of that, you damage your rims. Sometimes you get a puncture. And for the Kenya National Highway Authority, they should also do audit of the roads, which are busy, and they carry out repairs on the places which are very bad.
The situation has also disrupted the reopening of schools this week after the holiday break. Many children are still not able to attend their classes in some areas due to flooding. Even for those in the city, the conditions are not any better. Sarah Perez is a college student.
The rains inconvenienced the classes a lot. People get late to class. There was a day we actually ended up 3 people in class because the other school didn't make it because of the rains. And also affects traffic. It slows down and people get late to work and also class.
Weather forecasters expect continued rains with above average rainfall expected in several parts of western and central Kenya. The flooding has so far displaced over 240,000 people across the country, with humanitarian aid workers expecting that number to rise. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
Rains are continuing in the Ethiopian highlands, leading to the swelling of the Shebele and Juba rivers running through Somalia. So far, over 420,000 people have been affected by flooding in Somalia alone. Tens of thousands have lost their homes, and humanitarian relief workers are concerned about the spread of disease and malnutrition. Jalafa Isaac is an emergency response manager with Save the Children in Behela Tuwain, the worst affected town in the Harshabale state. Reporter William Eagle asked him for an update.
And the displacement in number has been increasing day after day because of the magnitude of the flooding. The total number is 180,000 people are believed and displaced from the Balatuina town and the riverine area. And right now, living in evacuated sites in the higher ground of the Balatuina district and along in the river sites and in the hills, which is a maximum 10 kilometers away from the flooded area.
The rains and the flooding come after many dry periods. What does that mean for the crops?
The flood has inflicted heavy damage on infrastructure, including standing crops, cereals like sorghum, maize, peanuts, and mostly the vegetable. All these were destroyed in the first days of the flood. And right now, the farmers escaped their life with their children from the flood-affected village. And right now, they are living in higher ground where they need humanitarian assistance.
What kind of food relief are they receiving?
So right now, some of the international NGOs and UN agencies are promised delivering food like cereals and the other foods like rice and sugar, oil. All of these things will not yet be distributed, but they are promised that they will bring all these foods to the flood-affected people. And right now, today, there has been some of the foods were distributed to some of the flood-affected families. And right now, most of the aid agencies, like UN agencies, are in the process of procuring system. And then I hope that the next week or the next first days, that they will, most of these people will receive some food.
What is being done to protect the community from cholera and other waterborne diseases?
And right now, we are the Save the Children is the WASH cluster lead, and right now, establish it in some of the hygiene promotion awareness and even and providing safe drinking water. And right now, we have the cluster has distributed in quantity of the hygiene kits and distributed to flood affected families. And right now, the situation seems to be under control. And right now, what we are fearing is that after the flood recedes and the people return back to their homes, where septic tanks and even the water source, most of the Belaguine main water source is the river and the shallow wells, and all these things has mixed. And right now, this is likely to encourage the incidence of waterborne diseases.
Do humanitarian agencies have enough support to help with this crisis situation?
And actually, the international NGOs have limited resources to help the people, and this was not expected. The humanitarian on the ground, unless they get an essential support from the donors and the other international NGOs, the aid agency operating here cannot solve unless that they get a support to sustain the response.
That's Jalafa Ishaq of Save the Children in the town of Beltowain in Somalia. He was speaking with reporter William Eagle. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Skip Sisk, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.